Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that particular chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet, and it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives, and secondarily because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. If you have any of those to share with us, please do so, giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you call that number, if you press 1 on your phone, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. I'll turn on the microphone, announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. If you would like to ask a question or get some feedback and you do not have the option to call or prefer not to call, you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. And or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. And if we get a comment or a question from you, we will address it on the internet show, and then as time allows, send you a notification about what day and time that occurred, so you can listen back to the archive for your comments or feedback. We greatly appreciate whenever anybody does that, because it just makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be of service, and that's just a lot easier to do when we know how these things are landing for you. What is of most benefit for you from the things we're doing on the internet show, the topics that come up, the books we read and comment on, the support we have for people who want to do worksheets, the support groups themselves. And today is a Tuesday, so that means there'll be another support group tonight. And the support groups are held from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time, Tuesdays and Thursdays. We're closing in here on 20 years of the Tuesday support group. That'll be in August. We'll finish 20 years of doing the Tuesday group. And the Thursday group's been around a little over 10, if I count correctly. So all the information you would need to join us, join that community, learn more about the worksheet process, learn more about the fundamental dynamics underlying the power in the worksheet processes, is all the information you need to join us for free is on mindshiftersacademy.org website, mindshiftersacademy.org. So, how can we support you? What's on your mind? How has the conversation about the way of mastery been landing for you? What would be of most use for you in spending this next hour of the first of our next 2 hours of Mind Shifters Radio? I've been hearing from people that they have varying levels of comfort with or resonance with Michael Singer's work, and I mentioned that because yesterday I had mentioned his podcast. Wherever you get your podcast, if you just go and click the link for Michael Singer podcast, it'll give you access to that. And some people just absolutely love it, and others just don't resonate with it, and that's why we keep bringing different teachers who are teaching essentially the same fundamental process and tools in the hope that eventually we'll present one that resonates for you. As I mentioned, I'm grateful to everyone who's joining us here today. I should also mention that today there was another podcast that dropped for the Journey's Dream On Your Mind podcast. And it was a bit of a stretch to get a full podcast interview with this person that was recommended, but it is available. This is a person who does some family therapy work using her own style, using some of the techniques that have been around for many years and blending them with energy work and her knowledge of trauma and working with addictions for many years. So that's available at theonyourmindpodcast.org or thejourneysdream.org/podcast website. So it is always great when we hear somebody, what can we do to support you today? What is your preference for how we proceed? Area code 610. Is this Susan?
Hi, Dr. Tim. I just wanted to say I listened to that new podcast this morning because somehow I guess I pressed something that means I'm told when you have a new one out. And I liked it very much and was thinking how wonderful it would be if we had been able to form the words or even have the idea that we as a family, I'm talking about my own family of origin, if we could have gone and talked to someone, just talked. I don't know about constellation work or any of those configurations. I tried that and maybe it was partly just a facilitator, but it was, to me, it was awkward, and I didn't really do very well with it. But just to have someone use, give us a new vocabulary and introduce the idea that things can be talked through, feelings can be brought out in the open, feelings we don't even know we have. I don't know how any of us in my family would ever have gone in to get help. The idea wouldn't have occurred to us. We thought we were fine. We weren't. We were functional, but and we had some great times, but there were things that would have done well to be addressed. One thing, and I've brought this up in different contexts before, she talks about getting our needs met. And I'm badly triggered by that, and I realize it's just a trigger. It's my stuff. But if we have somebody say, I need this, and you're not giving it to me, saying you need it means it's kind of too harsh. It's too much like a manipulation or a command. And I wish she had used the word want, that's all. But that was, I was translating throughout, because she talks a lot about getting your needs met. And it also sounds, this is my trigger, my worksheet material, it sounds extremely selfish to talk about getting my needs met all the time. Nevertheless, I got a lot out of that podcast. And you said it was a stretch. I didn't know what you meant by that.
Well, in the process of interviewing different people, some people are just naturally good at explaining what they do, and they're really good marketers and advertisers for their work. And others are probably better at the clinical part than describing it.
Right.
And so it was, that's just all I'll say, is that I think there's probably more solid value in her work than she was able to present. And, you know, she does a lot of the work. She can do it now through Zoom and through the internet, so people don't have to travel to see her in California, et cetera. And it's just, there's a lot of, like, every time there's a crisis, like something like the coronavirus and all of those restrictions that were on and everything, it's a big drain. And it usually results in many different benefits as people adapt.
Yeah.
One of the big benefits is that people have figured out how to provide mental health services through the internet and do it remotely for people, and that insurance companies quite a bit lightened up and decided they would reimburse for that where they never would before. So, you know, one of the reasons that I agree to interview someone like her is that she is able to provide those services remotely, though people won't have to travel all the way to, you know, wherever she is in California to benefit from that work.
Well, and you did a good job pulling stuff out of her. Your questions led her further along where she was going to say, which I thought was good. And I guess you felt as if there could have been more, but it was good.
I'm glad you think so. And this reminds me, you know, various things that you talk about having a family session, and it reminds me that several times already, just in yesterday's sessions that I had, the topic of listening and reflective listening from Robert Bolton's work, People Skills, and the Imago Dialogue from Harville Hendrick's book, Getting the Love You Want, and Michael Rice's Responsibility Communication came up several times yesterday in just one day's sessions, with people needing to understand how to build skills in listening You might say communicating, but really the big skill that we are not taught in our culture for the most part is how to listen and how to give people the gift of feeling heard and understood. We're really, whether it's conscious or unconscious, we're pretty much taught to listen with an ear to how to respond.
Yeah.
And we're not taught to listen in a way that can help us put ourselves in the position of the person we're listening to so that we can grasp the concepts and the responses they've had and the meanings they're giving things from their perspective rather than from ours.
Right. That's true. It's a great gift to be able to do that.
And that just reminded me that we had talked about the potential of, you know, you doing a responsibility communication, not that you would send it to this other person, but you would do it and then get your own benefit from it, and then perhaps do an automatic writing response as though the other person was had actually gotten your letter and was giving you feedback. And whether you did that or not, I'm just curious about how did that conversation sit with you now several days later?
I thought about it. I didn't do anything about it because I've got some family things that are right up in our faces, and I've been doing stuff on that. My one question from that discussion was, if I didn't, you didn't call it automatic writing before, but the idea that she would respond and I could write her response as I get it in my mind, I split into two Alices. One was the one I imagine she would really write, and the other one is what I would like her to write. And so I sort of did them in my head very, very, you know, inadequately because I didn't really do any of that. I didn't write a responsibility communication letter to her either. And there's things I could look at. You know, I think Gail Ryder mentioned that she had had, and maybe I'm misremembering, but she had had attachment issues all her life. Did she say that or did I make that up? And that she was dealing with those because I see this as my stuff, not hers at all. I was probably not aware who Alice was enough back then to be a good friend to her.
Well, I don't remember specifically if Dale was saying that she had attachment issues. I know she talked that, about how her work is focused on attachment work with families.
Yeah.
And with knowledge of that and helping people identify what it is that they feel they need, either, you know, in their lives or from their family members, and then how to help everybody in the family to whatever degree we can, get what they're thinking they need, whether it's to be heard or to be valued or to be supported in a certain way, et cetera. And, of course, a lot of that is related to the field of the area of study about attachments and how we form attachments in childhood and how that affects our lives all through our lives. And if we have parents who are loving and consistent and they fit our personality types, we get one level of attachment. And if we have parents that have their own issues or they just don't fit our personality type or they're swamped with, you know, busyness in life and we don't feel like we get what we need, then we develop different levels of attachment and issues with attachment. Or problems, you might say, with attachment.
Right. The title of her book, Surviving Irene, is that what it is? I can't remember. How I Survived Irene. Irene was the name of a hurricane, wasn't it, down south somewhere? So I thought she was going to talk about how she survived the chaos. But it turns out I think Irene is her grandmother.
Yeah.
Anyway, it just... Wow. Must have been one powerful lady.
Well, so I can strongly encourage you to continue the idea when you have time of unpacking some more of that stuff with this friend, even if
mm-hmm.
you don't involve that friend directly, because all of your issues around or about that friend they're inside you. They've got nothing to
yep.
do with her.
And they're like a paradigm of the relationship, whatever that was. But I don't know if paradigm's the right word, but what happened with her?
Like a template, yeah.
A template.
Like a template. A template for relationship that you downloaded in your early life in your family, and then when one way or another you use it, you either use it successfully
mm-hmm.
because it's a useful template, or you apply that template in different ways, and it creates difficulties and disruptions for you in your life, and that's what we all do, whether we realize it or not.
Yeah.
When
did
on
you
Thursday,
do that interview with her?
Oh, just a couple weeks ago.
Oh, okay. What were you saying?
On Thursday, I'm going to be interviewing a woman named Kelly Jensen. And Kelly has edited a book titled Don't Call Me Crazy, 33 Voices Start the Conversation About Mental Health. And it's people who have had lived experience of mental health challenges or struggles or labels or all three, and they've written about it. They've written essays or poems, et cetera. And it's right up our alley as a nonprofit, Journey's Dream, where we're trying to help rewrite the narrative on mental health to one
mm-hmm.
in which optimal health and well-being are possible and expected, and where mental health challenges can be moved from traumatic to transformational. And so here are 33 different people that have written about it, and she's edited this into a book.
Wow. And you've read the book.
I'm reading that book, and I'm going to be interviewing her on Thursday.
That
interview will post in a couple of weeks. But I thought I'd mention it just in case people are interested. There's just lots of good stuff. I have somebody that I knew for years in a public speaking group that I was the executive director of, and he identifies as being on the autism spectrum, and he has spent his career just being very honest about that and talking about it, writing about it, working with people, trying to help them stay productive or get more productive, even if they have some of those challenges from the autism spectrum. And he's got his own lived experience, plus he's got, I forget whether he's got two or three offspring that are all on the spectrum. So he's really a rich resource. And he just talks very, very honestly about it, just the way these people do in the book, Don't Call Me Crazy, 33
mm-hmm.
Voices That Start the Conversation About Mental Health. And that's by Kelly
Jensen. I thought you were going to say the book was about split personality. Yeah, 33 different personalities.
Different essays or poems or writings about this.
Mm.
So, that's something that's a good book if you have somebody in your life or you yourself have some questions about, you know, this book, 33 Voices, Starting the Conversation About Mental Health, covers depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, trichotillomania, which is, you know, obsessive hair pulling. It's just all over the map with the things that they've collected and people who are writing about their lived experience with these different symptom patterns or intense struggles, whether it's central nervous system dysregulation or depression or anxiety. So it's you know, 33 different authors collected in this one book. So it's not like, oh, it's a great author. It's just, it's a fascinating read. And it, you know, it has the potential to humanize and help people look in a more humane way upon anybody they know who's struggling. Because, you know, one of the things that our culture has a tendency to do is dehumanize those who are different.
Well, it's like homelessness.
Go to war. Yep, it's like homelessness or anything else. It's the only way we can go to war is dehumanize the people that we're going to go fight.
Right. That's so true about mental health issues. We feel, I mean, I know I have felt, I had a schizophrenic cousin, and she was strange ever since I knew her as a little girl. And finally she had a complete, I mean, she was had to be hospitalized and stayed in a hospital until she died at age 67, and she was younger than I was by 4 or 5 years. And I had the feeling that her, what was wrong with her made her as if she lived across a river from me. There was a huge boundary that I couldn't cross to reach her. And I didn't give her the credit for possibly being able to have a dialogue. I never knew her after she was put in the hospital. She was put away, but, you know, in the old style, the way they did. Lived far away. I never visited her, never wrote to her. So this is a great service if we can humanize and also teach ourselves that we can cross that boundary or remove it. And Journey's Dream, it sounds as if that's exactly what they've been doing all along.
That's the reason we have the 158 or more podcasts, just trying to get you know, a whole different level of awareness out there in the public about the patterns that people call mental illness and various forms of, quote, solution that are available or that people have tried and experienced that branch out away from allopathic medicine. And allopathic medicine these days has devolved into, here's a list of symptoms, let's pair that with a medication.
Yeah. So much pain, a lot of pain there. Well, there are some illnesses, too, that are considered more permeable to, I mean, the boundary between a, quote, healthy person and, say, a depressed person is different from one who's schizophrenic. I've put schizophrenics further away from reachability in my mind. So this will be great to read.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by reachability?
The ability to communicate and the desire to communicate. And I think in some ways I thought, well, that's it. I can't, that person is out of bounds for me now. I can't talk to them. We won't be able to communicate. Something crazy will happen.
It's fascinating that you used the phrase out of bounds, because I was just about to say that when dealing with somebody who's struggling, whatever the struggle is, whether it's alcoholism or schizophrenia or, you know, severe depression or anxiety, when you're dealing with somebody like that, it's really important to have good boundaries. And you just, as I was thinking of saying that, you said that for you they're out of bounds.
Well, say why. For instance, I have a close relative who's extremely dangerously depressed right now. And he has sworn me to secrecy, so I shouldn't even be talking about this. So I'm not naming anybody. But
well, but the reason I talk about the need for boundaries is because if you mistakenly fall into the pattern of believing that it's your job to fix or save somebody, and they buy into that with you, you can use all of your resources. You can end up destroying your life. You can drain yourself. You can get caught in, you know, in unbelievable scenarios of power struggles and trying to be responsible for things you have no control over, and you just get drained and exhausted.
Yeah.
Whereas if you keep
the
boundaries, if you understand it's not your job to live someone else's life for them, and, you know, for instance, if they don't want to talk to you, they are not going to talk to you, no matter how much you say, please just talk to me about this. If there's somebody who wants to drink, they're going to drink. It doesn't matter how much you say, I love you, and drink is ruining your life, please don't drink. They're going to keep drinking.
Yeah.
If you understand that it is not your job to fix or change somebody, then you'll watch how much energy you expend on things you don't have any control over, and you'll conserve your energy, and then you'll be available to live your life in a healthy, loving, joyful way, and or be there to be available to help other people who are willing to accept the help.
Yeah. All true.
That's what I'm talking about when I say it's so important to watch your boundaries when you're dealing with people who are really stuck or really sick physically, mentally, emotionally, however you want to talk about it. Because if you fall into the false belief that it's your job to fix or save them, you'll expend incredible amounts of energy for no reasonably good effect. And then you'll get drained and burned out. Usually, if you're like most of us, you'll generate a lot of resentment and bitterness toward the person because you'll think, you know, after all I'm doing for them, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. It's a very
It was fascinating. You said that this person is out of bounds for you.
Well,
which means you've drawn a boundary.
I have, and I don't feel responsible for that person, and I don't feel as if I caused it or am to blame in any way. Whereas with this depressed person, I feel very responsible. And it's totally worksheet material, and I've been doing them, doing visualizations and blessings and the whole, but I still feel just ill in myself because I feel as if I am completely tied up in the well-being of that person, and I won't be okay until they are okay. And I know that's just talk about no boundary at all. So I see the work that needs to be done, but I also have the feeling I can't do this. This is too big. Can't do this one.
Well, and the other thing that is, you know, bears mentioning is that you said this person, you know, wants their privacy or whatever. They are swearing you to confidentiality or whatever. And this is a part of what I talk about when I say boundaries. My general definition for boundaries is everything that I say and do that effectively communicates to other people what I think is acceptable and unacceptable. And every one of us is free to determine what we think is acceptable and unacceptable and then choose to live our lives based on that.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm dealing with people, and I'm, you know, licensed clinical psychologist and what they would say in certain states, a mandated reporter, the law says that I have to keep things confidential and I can't tell anybody anything about my work with people unless I have written permission from them about who I would tell and what I would tell them. And so I'm also a mandated reporter, which means that if I think somebody is going to hurt themselves or somebody else, or if I think I have information that indicates that somebody's going to hurt themselves or somebody else, then the law requires me to notify whoever I think I need to notify to protect whoever I think might be in danger.
Right.
So I tell people, when I see them in the beginning of our sessions, I say, this is the deal. Whatever you say to me is between you and me, and I'll have to get written permission from you before I share it with anybody else, unless I have reason to believe you're going to hurt yourself or somebody else, or you're in any way involved in elder or child abuse. And then the law would require me to notify whoever I think I need to notify to protect whoever I think might be in danger.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a qualifier. I will keep confidence. I'll keep your confidence. I'll keep it private, what you say to me, up to a point. I'm not going to keep it private if I think you or somebody else is in danger. And that's just me as a psychologist in the state, trying to abide by the state laws and the ethics of my profession, et cetera. But my ethics of my profession do not require me to stay quiet when I know somebody is going to get or is very likely to hurt themselves or somebody else.
Yeah.
And I've had a number of times in my personal life and my career where people have said to me, well, don't tell anybody, but, you know, I'm feeling suicidal. Or somebody comes to me and says, you know, so-and-so, a family member just told me that, you know, they swore me to secrecy, but they told me they're feeling suicidal. And I just pick up the phone and call the person. And everybody gets mad at me. And that's got to be okay, right?
Yeah.
This is like, right. I will not play games like that. And
yeah.
In some cases, I just tell the person, look, I'm concerned about you, and I'm going to go call an ambulance or police, unless you can give me, you know, reason not to right now. And other times I say, look, you're telling me on the phone right now that you're not feeling a real danger to yourself or others. So I just want you to know you're putting this other person in a very untenable situation by telling them, don't tell anybody, but I'm feeling suicidal. And so it's a manipulation and it's abusive. And so I'm going to blow the whistle on you. I'm not going to let this happen. And then you know what happens? People say, don't do that because then they'll not talk to me. And I say, it's got to be okay. Right? If somebody, one of the things I learned in my career over and over again was that if somebody wants to kill themselves, they'll find a way to do it, even if they're in a secure facility and they're on suicide watch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very intense thing. I don't, you know, call it what you want to call it, tragic or whatever else. It's a very real thing. That it's happened where I've worked in juvenile halls. It's happened where I've worked in psychiatric hospitals. It's happened where I've worked in regular hospitals. And it's very intense. And you'd think, well, geez, they've got all these people, all this training on how to prevent this, and it still happens anyway. How is that?
Mm-hmm.
Because if somebody really wants to do it, they're going to find a way to do it. Now, it doesn't mean we don't try to get them help or, you know, use whatever tools we have to alleviate their pain. We do all of that. And yet we don't participate in the game playing around it, at least from the professional perspective. And it's what I've encouraged people to do with their families in my caseload over the years, is to just say, look, tell people that you'll keep this private as long as no one's in danger. But if it gets to the point where you think they're really in danger, they might hurt themselves or somebody else, tell them right up front, hey, confidentiality doesn't hold here. I care too much about you and or the outcome of this or the other people that I think might be, you know, at risk. And so I'm going to shine the light on this. I'm going to bring this to people's awareness. I'm going to tell the professionals because X, Y, and Z is, you know, my what I think is best to do or who I think might be best equipped to help. And it sometimes makes people, you know, decide they're going to get all up in arms and they're going to blame me and blame everybody else. And I just have to say, okay, you have that choice too. You have a choice to choose to not talk to me again. You have a choice to hurt yourself. You have a choice to use the resources that are being offered or push them away. I can't live your life for you.
All right.
But what I'm advocating for here is that you or anybody else is in a situation like this, you pay attention to focusing your most of your energy on things you actually have control over because you do have your life to live.
Mm-hmm.
And what I tell people is I want to be able to put my head on the pillow at night knowing I did the best I could in X, Y, or Z situation.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that's making sense for you.
It makes sense. Yeah, it's making sense.
So we've been all over the map. We've been talking about listening skills and Michael Rice's responsibility communication and the Imago Dialogue from Harville Hendricks and Robert Bolton's reflective listening and boundaries and mental health.
Uh-huh.
Yeehaw!
Yeah.
How to put this one in the archives. But again, if you just keep coming back to the basics of whatever teaching that you like most, especially at times like this where it seems like you're way out over your skis.
Yeah.
And the basics of the way of mastery are you're creating your experience of life. So if you're getting all upset, you're getting all fearful, getting all agitated, obsessed with thoughts about something that you can't control, then come back to the basics and recognize, okay, I'm doing this. How am I doing this? What would I like to change?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, going way off center. Need to come back. The Serenity Prayer is very helpful. I mean, it's a great prayer. I'm not helped by it that much at the moment, but it's a very good prayer.
Well, and of course, one of the biggest difficulties with that is that we've been trained to identify a variety of things as they are under our control or they should be when, in fact, they're not.
Right.
And the shoulds just don't hold any water. All the shoulds do is create pain in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of my work with people is trying to help them get better and better at defining accurately what is it that they actually have control over.
Part of the feeling
once you've
of
done
control.
That, go ahead. Part of the feeling of what?
Of having not control, no control, is the sense of responsibility for things that happened in the past that you cannot do anything about now. Like, I watch how Tim Bingham was when he was, when we were first married. He was very, very depressed. And there were no medications out at that time. And it turns out later that some medications helped him for a short period of time, which gave him a glimpse into how it would be to feel well. But then they stopped being effective. And so he was one of those people that isn't responsive to depression medications. And he's used a lot of different tools, and he's working on one that seems to be this business of changing your neural pathways, changing your thought patterns. He's very much into this, and it's only been a couple of weeks, but he's very excited and hopeful, and even is saying, I think maybe I might. I mean, he's heavily medicated, and it's a blunderbuss approach. His doctor has said as much. We don't know what we're doing. We'll try this, we'll try that, and he's on multiple things, and so he's falling asleep a lot during the day. But going back to when he was young, one thing I realized is he had a straight old depression. It was awful, but he did not blame himself for being depressed or feel useless and like a bad person if he was depressed. And I was thinking, I'm looking back now because I realized that was wonderful that he didn't have that extra couple of layers of blaming himself and feeling useless. He would take time off, sometimes a couple of months from law practice, just to rest, because being terribly anxious for days and days on end is exhausting, and he would get exhausted, but he didn't blame himself. And now the person I'm talking about not only has depression, but blames himself for it, feels worthless because of it. And so we're talking about, am I responsible? But I feel as if some of my worthlessness issues were picked up by this person. You figured out who I'm talking about, but he's got not only my husband's depression, but he's got this other garbage that I handed to him as a young mother and with a little boy. So anyway,
again, the idea here is, what do you have any control over? Do you have a time machine? If you do, let's get in it, and we'll take it back to when he was young, and we'll change those things. If you don't, then let's focus on what you have control over now. Mm-hmm. And since you can't make him feel better about this and that, this is one of the things I tell people on a regular basis about the parenting stuff is, if I give you my Parenting Power Struggle Handbook and you read it and you go, oh my gosh, this is wonderful stuff, and oh boy, the next thought is, oh my God, I've ruined my kids because I didn't raise them like this. And I have to say, no, that's not the case. And if you begin to use the power struggle model in your own life, if you begin to work on your own depression, your own negative self-talk and blame, you're going to be giving your children one of the most powerful gifts they'll ever get. That is, you will be a living, breathing example of the fact that they're never going to be too old to learn and grow and change and become the kind of person they would like to be.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's
rather than
true,
focusing on, oh my gosh, oh what I did, oh this horrible, I'm so bad, which is just a repetition of the pattern you had when you were younger that you say caused the problem. How can you fix the problem by beating yourself up more now?
Yeah. Well,
I'll take a breath while you answer that question.
Okay.
How can you make it better by doing the same thing now that you say you're so upset that you did when he was younger?
That's
the answer,
true.
Of course, is you can't. It's insanity. So what's the best use of your mind energy, time, intelligence, money, and energy right now? Getting yourself to the place where you are happy, where you are whole, where you understand you're responsible for your life experience moment to moment, not anybody else's, that you can extend that loving energy that you identify as your core true self. And that is the best thing you can do for anybody you know, especially your family of origin.
Right. That's a good
because that actually has... That actually has the potential, not a pep talk, it's a description. That's the only thing that actually has any potential to be of benefit to the other person. And at the same time, you.
Yep. And I have been doing it. I hope it's momentary, but I've been down the tubes. But I want to get back there very fast so that I can be that example and that centeredness, and so they can see that and be encouraged by that. I want to do that.
Well, if there is anything that we can do to support you in that, please let us know, because that is the only thing that's likely to have any positive effect either on your life or theirs. And again, this
That's
is
true.
Right in line with the primary teaching in the Way of Mastery that says in the first lesson, here's the first axiom, you only experience the effects of your choices. You are creating your experience of life moment to moment by how you choose to focus your conscious awareness. And as you choose that focus, then how you choose to interpret and respond to what you believe you're experiencing.
That's true, and I can see the error of my thought because I've saved a slot for family members. That it's great and possible to do that with everything and everybody in the world, but not my kids. That's got to go.
Well, if it's false, let it go, please. Right. And you know, at some level you might say, well, but I have special responsibility and I have special power with my own family. I would advocate that, yeah, you do, but it's still going to function on the laws of energy and resonance the way every other energy does.
Yeah.
So if you really want to help them, make sure you put your own mask on first, to do the flight analogy.
Yeah.
Get yourself to the loving, happy, blissful state and recognition of your true nature and be extending that to them and everybody else in each moment. That's the best way to bring a blessing into their lives. Or you might say a correction into their lives. A correction of what? A correction of any pattern that you might have demonstrated for them in the past.
Right.
But beating yourself up about what you didn't do right as a parent in the past.
Yeah, I know. It's useless.
Please see that that's the same thing you say you're upset about now, that you think that's what damaged them in the first place, that you weren't such a happy camper when they were growing up. It's one of the amazing things about the conscious logical mind is that it can create these rationalizations and distortions and convince us that they're valid and true. And they're just purely idiotic. Right? It's how, you know, any one of us can be moved to do the same thing over and over and over again without getting the results we say we want. And
yeah.
and we get convinced that we're doing something differently, but somebody on the outside can be standing there watching us saying, gee, why is Tim beating his head against the same brick wall
mm-hmm.
for 4 or 5 years? It's the amazing power of our mind and our rationalizations to convince us that we're doing something differently when really we're doing the same thing over and over again. And that's why so many of these great teachings say, and Michael Rice would say, you got to be out of your mind. You got to get the conscious logical mind and put it on a shelf for now and ask to be mm-hmm. shown an entirely different way of seeing and responding to the situation
right.
than anything you've done in the past, because everything you've done in the past has led you to where you are.
It takes a great trust to do that. I want to have that.
How do you mean it takes a great trust to do that?
If I stepped into being absolutely okay and finding peace and allowing my person to go through what he's going through, observe it, be there, love, bless, but be centered and all right, have the boundary up. I would have to admit that I'm going to be that way. I'm going to be safe and okay even if he dies. Cancel the thought. That takes a lot of trust.
Well, I'm anticipating, based on what you're saying, I'm interpreting based on what you're saying that you think you don't have that trust yet. And so I'm going to try and
mm-hmm.
offer you a slightly different perspective.
Okay.
Right. So one that doesn't really require trust.
All right.
One that just requires direct observation. What's the observation? You said earlier in this call that you're blaming yourself for what somebody in your family of origin is going through right now, because when they were younger, your mood wasn't so great and you didn't, you know, treat yourself so kindly, et cetera, et cetera. So just stick to the logic that says, how could I fix that situation from the past by continuing to think negatively about myself and beat myself up and create fear and panic? So
mm-hmm.
just use the logic. You don't have to go to trust. You don't have to go to faith.
Choose differently.
Just see the logic that what you're saying is, oh my gosh, I think I harmed my family of origin members by being depressed and anxious and not being my best self. And that's horrible, and it's got me so depressed and anxious right now. And then just wake up and say, oh, wait a minute. Being depressed and anxious and not being my best self is exactly what I'm doing right now, and it's exactly what my mind is telling me caused this harm to the people I love.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm,
okay.
So I just offer that as an alternative to you saying, I need to have faith. You don't need to have faith. You just need to be able to see from a slightly different angle, oh, my gosh, look what I'm doing. I think it's different, and it's the
yeah.
same thing.
Yeah.
And when when any of us wakes up and sees, oh, my gosh, you know, Guy Finley says it this way. He says, the mind is just going to do what it does. It's going to keep automatically, it's got this mechanical level of mind. It's just going to keep doing what it does.
Mm-hmm.
until the mind itself wakes up and sees that it is the source of its pain, not the solution. It's going to keep doing it until it sees it differently. And that's why we're just offering you another way to look at this and encouraging you to keep looking for alternative ways to look at it until something clicks so that you can start feeling better in and of yourself and then extending that solid, better, loving energy to everyone around you.
Thanks, Dr. Jim. I know it's the end of the hour. So.
All right, it is. Blessings. I'll mute you and let you listen in. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Awesome conversation. Thank you.
You're welcome and deserving. Have a wonderful show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio, and today is Tuesday, March the 19th, 2024, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. We'll give Michael a moment to dial in. And thank you for listening, participating, asking questions. And we're glad that you're with us. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Delighted and honored that you're here, that we get to keep pursuing this mindset, this amazingly profound teaching that comes out of the lips of the first century Aramaic Yeshua on how to let loose of the mind of the past and step into the actual present, the actuality of what life is as human beings, what's possible, what we're capable of. That state that when a certain number of disciples were told what they needed to do, they said, who can understand that saying? Too hard a saying. And they left and didn't come back. We're looking to understand this word that we've spoken about several times, Rachma, which is a gateway filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that makes our human minds available for perception that comes from the actuality of what's going on in the world, rather than coming from or being a reflection of whatever stored in carbon-based memory that's resonated into activity by what's going on in the world. And where most people take what's stored in their carbon-based memory systems. Remember, we've talked about this idea that we store literally, energetically. I mean, they've proven they can take somebody and put them into a somnambulistic state of hypnosis, and they can take them back to the moment of their birth, and they can tell you who was in the room. They can tell you what mother's hairdo was. They can tell you the emotional state of everybody in the space. All of that information is recorded. It is all stored in carbon-based memory, what the ancient teachings refer to as Adam, Adamos, the red clay. So there's that mind, that perceptual construct that's always putting before us something that replicates its content and using that to cover up what would come in through what one might call the divine mind, or one might call come in from the actuality. And it's Rachma that prepares the space for the mind to be formed from actuality rather than from carbon-based memory. So we're talking about, you know, sort of competing minds. one of those minds, and this has nothing to do with religion, one of those minds is the mind of active present love. It was called the mind of Christ in you, not a religious idea. Christ in Aramaic being the name of an office, not a person's name. And so we either live in that mind, and that mind is fueled and powered by active present love, or we live in a mind that goes against that. So we have those two options. The mind that goes against the mind of love will take everything that love has to say, turn it around, and find a way to abuse you with it. Find a way to send you to hell. Find a way to tell you that love has got this horrid place for you. It has all kinds of insanity, and the insanity that it holds is stored in this carbon-based memory system. If you took your carbon-based memory system, multi-generational database called your body-mind unit, into the chemist shop and had them do a breakdown of the elements of your carbon-based memory, they would tell you that your body-mind unit is made of carbon. And they would further tell you that a natural carbon atom has 6 electrons, 6 protons, and 6 neutrons. 666. Does that number mean anything to anybody? So we have the mind of love, or what was called the mind of Christ, and then the mind that goes against that, which is what? The anti-Christ. It is this perceptual system that is relentless and always has something to say about everything. If you listen to this man Yeshua from 2,000 years ago, he said, I have a pathway due to the truth of your life. I have a pathway to your perfect life. In fact, he said, and he said, it's the words. Perception is run by words. The mind is run by words in the human realm. Broca's area is right next door to the emotional center. It's a place where words are processed, are right there with words, and that's why a specific word can trigger somebody into a fit of rage or what have you, activated from carbon-based memory. Who has heard the words that came out of Yeshua's mouth? Nobody in the West has. So what we're looking to do as we're going through this dictionary, as we're going through the Enlightenment book, is we're looking to build the brain cells to actually be able to hear the words, those perfect words that are your perfect life, that is the instruction set, not something magical, not something mysterious, not something mystical, just simply what takes this carbon-based memory system into the point where it shuts up. Forgiveness is one of the keys to it. And you remember that Lenin, the man probably responsible for more deaths on planet Earth than any human being in history, said the way you destroy a culture is change the meaning of its words. And so what we're looking to do is to return to brain cells so we can actually hear what was being said and facilitate carbon-based memory in letting go, in forgiving. There's a man named Rabula. His name is the root of our word today that we would call rabble-rouser. He was a priest. Seems like he understood what Lenin was saying about destroying the meaning of words, because he went on a rampage and destroyed all the Aramaic Bibles he could find and replaced them with his own translations, changing the meanings of Yeshua's words to those that he decided were correct. And you remember in those ancient teachings they said, every word will be accounted for. Every word represents an energy frequency, and we're looking to get to the point where we set this carbon-based memory system up so that it has in it the space for divine perception, to be sourced from the energetic pattern of the actuality in which we live, move, and have our being, rather than the relentless carbon-based memory system that always injects its drama, its trauma, its game, its hostilities, its fears, its prejudices, its terrors, and its traumas. The trick is getting that thing to let go and remembering that the core tool of Yeshua was that of forgiveness. What does forgiveness do? It gets carbon-based memory to let go, whatever its construct is. When forgiveness is activated, that construct of carbon-based memory collapses. Now, you'll notice that the ego mind came back, and now we have a thing that's globally known called forgiveness, and it goes like this. I'm in pain, and it's really clear to me that it's all your fault, but it's okay, I'll forgive you. I'll let you off the hook, and we have people running around the world, I forgive you, I forgive you, I forgive you, I forgive you, and look at the mess. Please, never, ever forgive anyone for anything. And to that, I often have people say, oh, that's right, I have to forgive myself. No, please, never, ever attempt to forgive yourself for anything. But forgive continuously. That is, apply the tool called forgiveness, which in the first century Aramaic language is how you collapse what's going on in carbon-based memory. It's how you get that mind, the mind of Adamos, the mind of man, as it was referred to in the ancient scriptures, and you get that sucker to shut up. And when you get it to shut up, as the Course in Miracles says, you now have a clean and open space within your mind for Christ to come. You now have a clean and open space where the still small voice, where the subtler energy of active present love will write the meanings in your mind, no matter what you're facing. And you can't beat that guidance system with a stick. But it is a process. One of the core facilitators of that process in us was called in Aramaic Ruach HaKodesh. It is the breath. So the activity of the breath becomes key in the process. Persian word paraklita. In Persian, is to break loose or to break away. Lita, the curse of, the effects of error, or doings that are unfit. So John 14:26 ends up becoming she who breaks off the effects of doings which are unfit in you. And then once you realize the Aramaic meaning of this word, then you realize that this word represents the power that has the ability, unless denied, to collapse, to undo carbon-based memory. and what's at the root of it, all of the effects of that. And yet so many people are committed to their drama and their trauma and their pain and their perceptions of blame, their commitment to the one world universal religion of blame. There's somebody whose fault this is. That mind will not let go in them. And that is the denial of this power, that when we step in through willingness and acceptance, will undo all of the effects of our errors for all time. And then, on the other end of the equation, that's the power that will teach us the truth. So that's where we want to head. Overall, we're going to change, we're going to look at and shift back to change out of the carbon-based memories interpretation and get back to the truth. So that's what we're here to do. And we're delighted that you're here to be part of that conversation. And Ms. Jean, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
No, it is all quiet on this end.
Well, if I had my druthers, that's exactly where I'd be at this point, quiet. Just in that space of silence. It's kind of hard to communicate when we're broadcasting like this out of silence. So we'll move forward. So we were on page 74 in the dictionary, running through some of the dictionary definitions of words to create a foundation for going through these passages that we're going to cover. And we're about halfway down the page at the word C-E-A-N, seen, as in Dadsin, pure, clean, sound, free of fault. And that's what we're looking to do. That's what the Beatitudes are talking about in having a mind that is free of fault. Mind that is literally fueled by the active presence of love. A completely sound and purified mind. So that beatitude that's historically interpreted as, and people call it a translation, it really isn't a translation, but it says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, in Aramaic. It's you who have a completely purified mind, you will comprehend the invisible source of creation. And as that space opens in you, it's like nobody wants anything else. Once that comes into action. So that word from the Aramaic Beatitude, Dadsin, Matthew 5:8, Beatitudes, where the constructs of your mind are free of fault, free of what carbon-based memory would give them. That there's nothing based in hostility or fear to defile the mind, to defile the verbal system. And when you've done that work, then what the Beatitude in Aramaic says is you will literally have an ability to comprehend the Creator directly. Pretty giant promise. And the key in that one again is Ruka Tikutcha. She who breaks off the effects of doings which are unfit. What is unfit? Unfit for a human life is any form of hostility or fear. And they talk about, you know, remembering that the word sin in Aramaic is an archery term, means off the mark. They talk about how God can't look on sin, and it becomes some sort of a mysterious, you know, what does that even mean? But all that it means is in your essence, where you are created of the active presence of love, there is no room for, there is no resonance with, there is no possibility of even conceiving of that energy. It's the mind that holds it and structures it over and over and over again, and we fall out of awareness of who we are as created love, and we fall into identification with a false self that's based in defense, that's based in hostility and fear. Letting go is not an easy thing for that mind. And it is carried on the breath. So this prefix, the apostrophe, page 74, just beneath the definition of that word, C-E-A-N, pure, clean sound, free of fault, and it's a C-Kudja, that elemental force for that which is proper. So it's that which, it's the root of the word kosher, what's proper for humans. It's free of anything based in any form of hostility or fear. And that's ultimately what we need to do with our minds. The apostrophe being a prefix that speaks of something that is. So the Matthew 12:32, datid, is that which is to come. So ultimately, where do we end up? We end up in this space, which is to come, which is the place where we are freed of, if we're willing to do the work involved, if we're willing to have the work done in us, if we're willing to set free that feminine elemental force in us, breaks off the effects of that which is unfit. What is unfit? Just how many generations has this unfit energy? Just take a look at the world. Just turn on the television set, and you'll see what's unfit for humans virtually continuously. Can you get that unfit mind to let go for even a minute? If you do, everything in your life will be transformed. And then another prefix, DA or DAD, that it is complete. The entire thing has to go. So John 1:14, Damali, complete, filled, complete truth, complete beyond even belief. And then Degali, those who commit. So go back and look at this word, Degel, just down below. We're back to the Beatitudes, a mind structure or a set of mind underlying mendacious, lying, falsifying, treacherous, deceiving speech or action. If one is lost in that, if one is committed to that, it's the opposite of what the Beatitudes are inviting us to do. And when one becomes so ensconced in that, so captured in that state, it's almost as though the prompting of Rukha, there's no room for it to land. There's no place for it. There's no resonance left. In the same way that, you know, they talked about the Creator cannot look upon sin, those energies that are off the mark. And it isn't that, you know, eyeballs aren't going to look at it. It's that there's just no resonance. There's no place for that energy to land in it. And when one becomes so steeped in the hostility and fear game, it's like there's no place for the activation or the resonance of that which is exculpatory. Fortunately, when you understand the physics of it, there is this thing called resonance. You know, those who would say, well, someone who's stuck in that, well, they're just lost. That's it. They're lost. But when you understand the process of resonance, if someone is committed to being that space of active present love, because behind all of the shadows, no matter how deeply one has fallen into that, what's been called that lost state, because the essence of each of us remains the same, to stand as the space of conscious active love is to give possibility to those who appear to be lost. Remembering that we live, move, and have our being in this energy system called love, with free will and the ability to void the presence of love. And the one who's lost in that depth of hostility and fear tends to resonate the same in those around them and seem to be lost. But one who understands that resonance of that line from the worksheet, and I go back to this because it was insight for me. This is about 35 years ago. We started in a school in Delray Beach, Florida, kindergarten to grade 8. And this was so present for me at that point that the first lesson we went in for a full month, we picked a theme for the month, and there were 4 different teachers that I worked with in establishing that school or that program in the school, which is still running, called Lessons in Living. And the first lesson in that month that everybody went in to bring to these kids from kindergarten to grade 8 is, when I choose love, it wakes up the love in everyone. How powerfully committed am I to holding to that presence of love? And what is there in me based in hostility or fear that can break me away from that presence of love? That's what needs to be weakened. That's what needs to be repeatedly de-energized or forgiven. And that's where Yeshua said 77 times, 70 times forgiveness, to weaken the grip, the grasp of that non-being self one of the keys to that is to make sure that you fully allow this feminine elemental force that breaks off the effects of errors into your life. And it is literally the breath. So if one is stuck in that mind structure, mendacious, lying, falsifying, treacherous, deceiving speech or action, and then if we take a look at the suffix "uta," O-O-T-H, let's go back and take a look at that. If you slide back in the dictionary to page 90, up toward the top. Uta is a suffix. So when you add this to a word, it designates an unconscious mindset or attitude has controlled perception, reason, and memory, and is now lifted in function from a control set to physical action of decided judgment. So another word or another way to understand when this suffix is added to a word is that we could say, this person is now, in regard to that issue, in the desert. An unconscious mindset is controlling everything. So if we go back to page 74, Dagaluta. Dagal, this mendacious, lying, falsifying set. Uta is coming from the unconscious, and it controls perception, reason, memory. This is why some people, it's like there's just no reasoning, there's no breaking through it, because this is, and this is what was, you know, that this came as part of the package when you heard these words in Aramaic. This was just natural. I mean, there's nothing that even reflects this meaning in Aramaic without going to paragraphs of words. But if one's being controlled from that state, maybe controls everything in that person's mind. So there are several examples given with variations on the theme of that. Matthew 5:11, deceitfully, 5:33, deceiving, 7:15, deceiving. The kosher, the area swept by the bride's train during the wedding ceremony. So if one's at a wedding ceremony, the train would basically sweep along the floor. And so it would indicate an area, and in Matthew 5:35, it's domain. It speaks of that area that's controlled by that part of the mind. Then moving into being controlled by one's own temptations. Damnasi, Matthew 4:3. Building brain cells. And when we're speaking of one, we're talking about this human being. Speaking of the individual human created essence, or in Aramaic, nafsha. So we have the word nafsha describing the created human being, and we have the word adamos describing the physiological expression. And ultimately, you know, when we're talking about a domain here, we're looking for this mind and this unconscious to be the domain of nafsha, to be controlled by this present love, that when connected with breath, undoes the unconscious dynamics of degeneration. So we're looking to awaken the nafsha. Awakening, you know, when we listen to Yeshua, he says, in order for you to live, you've got to die. That doesn't mean your physical body needs to die. It's saying that your identification with a self based in hostility or fear has to be loosed. You have to be freed from it. And for nafsha, the created essence, to take over. And it's not an easy thing to understand if we go to, but what we're looking to do is to make this whole domain that's being spoken of here the domain of conscious awareness from being, from nafsha, page 84. We'll see, and then what I'd like to do is just read through. Again, we're building brain cells for the mind to be able to support a different perception. So nafsha. There can be no doubt that the concept to be cued by nafsha is one of the most fundamental of all Aramaic comprehensions utilized by the prophets. In the Aramaic teachings of Yeshua, he states that all law hangs upon two commandments, as follows. Well, and let me make a shift there, because again, this is before we really comprehended the misuse of the word love. So have rachma for the Creator in your entire mind. So people think of the mind, they think of what they're conscious of, but we're not talking about that with the Aramaic. We're talking about the entire mind into the depths of the unconscious, which, you know, I forget what year it was, but Freud was given awards for discovering the unconscious. Or pardon me, let me correct that language, for rediscovering the unconscious, because it's built into the syntax of the Aramaic language. It was so well understood. And yet, in the Western world, there was no such concept. So have rachma for the Creator in your entire mind. In other words, you're going to, in order to keep this so that everything related to the Creator is based in love, you're going to have to clean out your entire mind so that rachma remains the only active filter in the mind. And with your whole nafsha, and in all your actions and in all your thoughts, have rachma for your neighbor as your nafsha. And when we take that one to the next level, then we realize that it is the way to maintain the source of perception as coming through being, coming from the truth of who we are. So the first appearance of nafsha here in these passages in Matthew is usually rendered as soul. The second is rendered as self. The concept soul, well, of Greek origin, is a cornerstone in Christian teaching. The concept of self is a cornerstone of psychiatry and psychology. Usually these two words, self and soul, are seen to be somewhat conflicting, yet under the Aramaic language, they are the same word, nafsha. So it is all-inclusive. Clearly, the concept behind nafsha is unknown in the West. Scholars have long sought to unify soul and self without success. If the meaning of nafsha could be ascertained, the unification is obtained, for the word is the source of both soul and self. To assist in defining the concept, it's helpful to review its uses by one who fully understood it. Fortunately, it's used many times by Yeshua in the Gospel of Matthew, and it's the only gospel first preached and written in Aramaic. So general familiarity with the style used by Yeshua in discourse is helpful in gaining insight into the term he used, as it also is some of the peculiarities of the Aramaic thought patterns throughout his teaching. Yeshua would state a truth well understood by his listeners and then expand from it in logical steps to make his point. With this in mind, several uses of nafsha occur, which Yeshua apparently felt would be fully understood by those listening. After healing the leper, Yeshua is reported to have told him, "Go and show your nafsha to the priests." Here he was using nafsha with the assumption it was understood as it was understood by the ordinary person. In this use, it appears to mean the healed appearance of the former leper. And my offering would be that it would be show that nafsha is back as the control mechanism over physiology, and when nafsha is fully in control of physiology of Adamos, there is no disease possible. I was on to say it should be kept in mind that the Aramaic does not usually employ a verbal distinction between a cause and its effect. While nafsha relates to the physical effect here, the clearing of leprosy could literally mean the underlying control of the body which has caused this effect and convey exactly the same understanding. So having nafsha, you know, he's saying go and show your nafsha. There's no distinction between cause and effect. If nafsha, if your created essence is in control of your physiology, you are whole, you are well, you are holy in expression. No disease is possible. And then in Matthew 12:25, Yeshua uses nafsha with the apparent belief, as again it was understood by his listeners, when he states, "For every kingdom you divide against its nafsha will decay, and every house and city which will be divided against this nafsha will not last." So if our created essence is love, and to me that word is totally undefinable, but if you hold a newborn child, you can have an experiential definition of the word love. Kind of impossible to put into words, but the words that, you know, of the thousands of people over the years that we've asked to go to their experience of holding a newborn child and describe the essence of the newborn, the words are always things like purity, sweetness, love, harmony, awesome presence. That's usually when Jeannie would ask that question in a workshop over the years, the first place my mind when I would tap in would go would be to the birth of my daughter as she took her first breath and sent me literally into another world. And the only way I could describe it was the awesome presence that was her nafsha. So when we're divided against that presence of love in us, then what does he say will happen? Decay. And every house and city which shall be divided against its nafsha will not last. With this use, nafsha shows that as the basic control, the fundamental controlling of source of life for a city, a house, or a kingdom. Here the word appears related to a controlling source or cause and not to its effect. The breadth and scope of the controlling cause, the life force of the city, house, or kingdom, designated by nafsha, seems to be total. For to run counter to it is death for that city, house, or kingdom. In Matthew 9:12, it is stated by the writer of the gospel, with the apparent belief that he would be understood, that a woman desiring to be healed of a 12-year flow of blood was saying in her nafsha, even if I only touch the fringe of his garment, I shall be healed. And so that's coming from her nafsha, and we're not talking about touching a literal garment. That's a metaphor for stepping into a more powerfully connected nafsha or field of love, and that she knows that she's ready to process out whatever that disease is about. All she needs is that extra bit of oomph, that extra increase in vitality that she will get by touching into Yeshua's energy field. So immediately thereafter, she did exactly what she was saying in her nafsha, indicating the set or goal within her nafsha controlled her behavior. So she moved into the place where she touched into his field and was instantly healed. The Aramaic Gospel of John, which was first stated in the Greek, the concept will is tied to nafsha with these words attributed to Yeshua. I cannot, in the word translate, I cannot from my own selfhood, nafsha, undertake anything. Even while I am hearing, I condemn, and my decision is just, for I do not seek that my will be served, but rather the will of him who sent me. So he's surrendering to guidance here. Clearly, there is in this statement recognition of nafsha as the source of control for judgment and comprehension, but not initiating control. So here the nafsha is going into agreement with guidance. And that guidance would be that which comes from Rukka. And how do we surrender to that? One of the keys is with the breath. Also indicated is the fact that nafsha is subservient and must yield or alter its effect to conform to a person's will, person's goals. So once one has accepted that deeper command, then everything else falls into line. There's that powerful space in the Course of Miracles that speaks of once you've accepted Rukka's plan, there will be nothing else to be concerned about. For she will go before you, making straight your path and leaving in your way no stones to trip on, no obstacles to bar your way. Nothing you need will be denied you, not one seeming difficulty, but will melt away before you reach it. You need take thought for nothing, careless of everything, except one person that you would, purpose that you would fulfill. And its fulfillment is guaranteed because it rests on you. A son or daughter, the offspring of the Creator. So So nafsha here is aligning with a higher will. And falling into harmony with that. And from the above uses, we're heading over now to page 86, from the above uses, it is abundantly clear that nafsha at the time of Yeshua was generally understood as the control entity behind the physical, mental, and behaving self. The cause level of mind. With the unification of cause and effect implicit in Aramaic, and the unification of control source, or the mental and physical implicit in its uses, nafsha therefore stands for all mental and physical conditions, and the control, the source of mental and physical development. This span of meaning lays the basis for its translations in the varied English words as soul, self, itself, and life. And seeing as we're down to the last 10 minutes, I'm going to just open the space so that if there's anything based on what we've covered so far, there's a bit of an opportunity for questions or thoughts. So if you're out there in listener land and you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And if you call that number, you'll be listening to the show directly. And then if you have a question, all you do is push 1, hand will go up in the control panel, and Jeannie will see that hand go up, and she will know that you want to talk to us. So, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up? Anything happening in the chat room?
Not. No. We have 5 minutes. Come on, somebody press 1.
You're out there in listener land. Is all of this fitting? Is it making sense? Again, we're looking to build brain cells to comprehend what these words in Aramaic, as Yeshua proclaimed them, my words are your perfect life, to come into harmony with, to build the brain cells for a comprehension that just doesn't exist in the English language. And ideas that there's just no... there's no verbiage for in Latin, in Greek, or in English. As you can see, and we're only about halfway through the writing on this word nafsha, one word that we thought we understood, and now we see how it ties into control sets, mindsets, unconscious, conscious. I mean, it just ties so much together that doesn't even start to resonate through the use of English words. Is it fitting and making sense, and or does it resonate a question for you if you're out there listening? So we'll just move forward with another paragraph or two, and we'll complete this idea of nafsha tomorrow. So again, this word, it's been translated by a number of English words, and none of them even starting to comprehend what this essay is about. It's been translated by the words soul, self, itself, and life. So also, it may be noted that there is, in the above-quoted uses, the implied suggestion that nafsha may have a quality of performance meaning. With the leper, the instruction to show his nafsha suggests his nafsha might have changed for the better or might have improved its performance. With respect to the nafsha of a city, a house, or a kingdom, an implication of correctness, of truth in addition to controlling power, envelops the meaning of the word. This implication of quality of effect, but mixed with an intrinsic tie to truth, is borne out in other statements. These are instructional statements of Yeshua, apparently intended to inform, to teach, rather than to communicate, through the use of a mutually understood term. In Matthew 6:25, the quality of performance, fact of control, and tie to truth elements of Nafsha all appear where he gives instructions on making things easier for Nafsha. Do not burden your Nafsha over what you shall eat, or what you shall drink, or what you shall clothes you shall wear. Is not Nafsha greater than nourishment, and your life greater than garments? In line with the thought of Matthew 6:25, he indicates in Matthew 6:33, the results achieved by Nafsha varies in conformity with the propriety of an individual's goal or set of will, where in Matthew 6:33, he says, seek first before everything. And we could understand that kingdom of God to be the community of love. So ultimately, that's where we're heading with everything to do with this series on the Enlightenment book, to reach to eradicating everything that would inhibit one functioning from the presence of love and being restored fully to our human lives as human beings. And so delighted to share this time with you, and we'll look forward to meeting with you again tomorrow. Blessings. Thanks for joining us.